This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we turn our attention upwards and outwards to space. There's a lot happening in our solar system lately, from astronauts making their way to the International Space Station to a birthday card from the Hubble Telescope. David Eicher is editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's start with something on the more sad side, and you wrote about this, astronaut Michael Collins passed away this week at the age of 90. He played a huge role in the Apollo 11 mission. David, could you tell us some about Michael Collins?
It is a very sad day yesterday in that he was really a wonderful guy and a funny man and, of course, very smart, being the command module pilot for that first lunar landing, Apollo 11. He was a great guy. And everyone in the world who ever met Mike Collins after 1969 asked him, weren't you the loneliest guy in the universe when Armstrong and Aldrin were down on the lunar surface and you weren't? And he told me a number of times, no, you know, I really loved being up in the capsule and sort of looking over the mission. And he wasn't worried about himself. He was worried about the fact that the LEM, the lunar module engine, might not start and that Armstrong and Aldrin, his two pals, may permanently be on the lunar surface. But he was a really wonderful guy. And it's a sad thing that we've gotten to know some of these Apollo fellows so well and we're losing them slowly here because they're up there in age. But he was a great man, hero.
And this is a guy who's done one of the most unique things in the world, right? He took a couple spins around the moon as part of the landing. Did he talk about it as this sort of like monumental experience, or was it his job? This is just what we do.
You know, the enormity of it and the significance to humanity, I think, was not lost on these guys. Every one of them, you talk to the Apollo astronauts, they, to a man, talked about holding up their thumb at arm's length and being able to block Earth, you know, and that little tiny planet where all of human history, everything that we know, everything that we've experienced throughout the whole of our civilization is blotted out by your thumb. You know, what a tiny little place in the universe it was. But these guys were professionals. They were very slick. They were doing their jobs. They were cool as ice, doing what had to be done to take care of business. So they were both sort of human, but exceptionally calm, professional scientists and engineers.
Well, and then here we are this week, four more professionals. Four astronauts made it to the International Space Station on board SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule Endeavour. Now, this is a recycled capsule. It got another use. Why is that a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal in that we have really a new age of public and private space exploration, and we have the capability now, without other nations being involved, of getting people up to the station and on beyond, because we hope, of course, in a few years to go back to the moon and maybe eventually go to Mars, which is going to be an incredibly complex and expensive and multinational mission that really will require the kinds of money where multiple nations and public and private companies will have to work with governments. So Elon Musk, yeah, leading the way, and others, Bezos and others, that's really an important, significant thing to test these engineering steps to have the capability to get back to where we were with Mike Collins 50 years ago and go beyond that point.
And speaking of international cooperation, this was an international crew, right? U.S., Japan, and I think France all represented in this four-person crew?
That's right. Exactly right. And so there's a group that's coming back due to splashdown. They were delayed a little bit on Saturday in the Atlantic near Florida. But this is an international – both groups were international. There was a Japanese astronaut on each of the two, and one of the groups contained a European Union member as well from France, as you mentioned. So, you know, that kind of international cooperation, it's going to have to be the way to get deeper into space, because as Douglas Adams said many years ago, space is really, really big and it's dangerous. And so we need all of humanity to work together.
Talking to David Eicher, editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, looking at some of the latest big news from space, near and far. And here's a story that combines both of those, David. Hubble, nearby in our Earth orbit here, celebrated its 31st birthday. Lots of pictures in that 31 years. And I guess on the actual birthday, it sent us this pretty unique stellar photograph. Well, what did we see?
It did. And of course, it's been the workhorse for astronomy over the last generation. It's done more than any other instrument to increase our understanding of the universe by orders of magnitude. It's a great achievement and a great anniversary. And it's nice that after 31 years, it's still going strong, too. But it looked at a star, a very funny star called AG Carinae, which is a so-called luminous blue variable. Now, this is a very big, massive star that is about 100 times larger than our sun. It's about a million times brighter than the sun. It's one of the brightest stars in our Milky Way galaxy, which has about 400 billion stars in it. And it's unstable. It's late in its life, and it's going from what astronomers call a supergiant star to a strange kind of critter that's called a Wolf-Rayet star. And that is when the atmosphere of this star strips off and it radiates, it sears the surrounding space in radiation, and it's creating a nebula that's expanding, that is glowing, and a shell that you can see. And that's what this beautiful picture that you can see on the Hubble site is all about.
And David, you and I have talked in the past about Hubble, and I've heard, I think, from you and from some others that astronomy you can kind of divide into before Hubble and after Hubble in some ways. How much has this revolutionized our view of the cosmos?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's really incalculable because we've had an enormous history of astronomy, you know, and of astrophysics, of understanding the physics behind the objects rather than just cataloging them for 150 years. But really, Hubble has taken us to a new understanding of the age, of the size, of the fate of the universe, of how the earliest galaxies and stars likely formed, of what will happen to our solar system. The whole picture, we're really in a golden age of understanding how the universe works more than ever before. And a large part of that is because of the last generation and the Hubble Space Telescope.
Well, let's get back closer to home now on Mars. We've got the rover there, of course, and now we've got this Ingenuity little mini chopper guy. It's had 3 successful flights so far. I think I saw earlier today the 4th one delayed. Can you talk about what this could lead to on Mars?
It had a little technological glitch this morning. It was supposed to have a 4th flight, and there was a little hiccup in the software. I don't think it's anything to worry about. But this is really a technology demonstration with this little tiny helicopter, which appropriately is landing on a little spot near the Jezero crater that's being explored, called Wright Brothers Field. They call it. This is the first flight on another planet in history other than Earth. And it's a little tiny craft. It's a 4-pound, 2-foot-high craft, roughly. And what they're doing is simply testing a flight which will aid in the future other missions to be able to image the planet, to understand the mineralogy around on Mars, and, of course, lead us to the ultimate question: could there have been life in the water that existed on Mars on the surface a long time ago? So this is really a sort of a technological test. It's hard because the Martian atmosphere is much thinner than Earth, so it's tricky. And so we have to have a small energetic craft to do it. But it looks like, with the exception of a small slip this morning, that everything is going pretty well for Ingenuity.
And speaking of Mars, China has, I think it's in orbit now around Mars, their own rover. They're aiming to land it next month. What do we know about their expedition?
Well, I'll tell you, I was at a meeting a few years ago, and there was a fellow from the Chinese Space Agency who was an official there, and China has an unbelievably ambitious, incredibly expensive suite of missions planned to basically do what the entire Western world has done for themselves. So China will push ahead, I think, with these missions and in a sort of an analogous track, compete with what Western nations have done and try to learn a lot about their own planetary science program. And we can hope, of course, in the future that there's a lot of sharing. Scientists tend to be apolitical and share data and work together. So I hope that will happen here between the West and with China. But they're very ambitious, they're serious, and they're shoveling an enormous amount of money into these projects.
And another topic we've talked about some before, David, exoplanets. We're spotting more and more planets and solar systems outside our own. And one thing, I saw a piece on this, one thing that research has been looking for is oxygen in the atmosphere as a likely sign of potentially planets that could support life. And some argument about whether that's really a sure sign. What are we looking for out there?
Well, that's right. You're exactly right. And of course, this is another huge cottage industry in astronomy that has really only taken place in the last generation. Now, we know of more than 4,700 planets orbiting other stars, other than the sun around us in our galaxy. And of course, oxygen is a major tracer for life on Earth. When there were enough microbes 2.6 billion years ago, finally on our planet, they became very plentiful. We had an explosion in oxygen on Earth, and that changed Earth and its atmosphere, its chemistry, its mineralogy, everything. It made life flourish then, which included us. So astronomers look for biosignatures, they call them. That is, in the light of these, in the spectra of these worlds, clues that maybe there is a lot of a particular kind of gas like oxygen that would favor life. But there's a new study, as you said, that sort of contradicts the hopes for looking for oxygen around on these planets. Maybe you could have very watery worlds that don't have life. Maybe you could have dry desert worlds that have a steamy atmosphere, nonetheless, because of their chemistry. Maybe you could have worlds that have a very high carbon dioxide to water ratio. That would create a sort of a runaway greenhouse effect, what we have on Venus here in our solar system. That would keep a lot of oxygen mixed up in the atmosphere, maybe without living beings. So we have to be careful about seeing something. They're so far away, these stars. We're not going to, walk out of a spacecraft onto them. So if we detect life, it's going to have to be with radio signals of intelligence, or we're going to have to try to detect it chemically like this from exoplanets. So this gives us some pause about what we conclude.
As we wrap up, David, cloudy right now, but are there any celestial events that we can observe in our night sky coming up anytime soon?
Oh, boy. Well, there are meteors going on right now. There are frequent meteor showers, and in August is the best one. That's a good one to sort of get into observational astronomy. In mid-August, the Perseid meteors. And, of course, you can see there we just had a very bright full moon a couple nights ago, and we've got some big things like eclipses of the sun and moon coming later this year that will be very exciting as well.
Probably talk to you again when that happens. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Eicher is the editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. He joined us to talk about the latest news about space.